You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening. Welcome to Aloud at Central Library. I'm so pleased to see you here tonight. We're very thrilled to have our Lieutenant Governor here with us tonight. Gavin Newsom is the 49th Lieutenant Governor of the state of California, which follows his two terms as the youngest mayor elected in San Francisco in over 100 years. Previously, he founded 15 small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area and now hosts the Gavin Newsom Show on Current TV. His newest book is Citizenville, Connecting People and Government in the Digital Age. In Citizenville, he asks, how do we get more people engaged? How do we revitalize our democracy? And is it possible for Americans to better their future by reinventing their relationship with government? Newsom explores how a modern digital government could house the information, concerns, convictions, even the protests of an enlightened digital citizenry. And, of course, it's a wonderful place to discuss this in a library which is going through at the forefront of the digital revolution. The future is sharing open data, open participation, open source, open everything, Newsom writes, and it must happen at every level. He points out how for digital natives, and how many of you here are digital natives? Do you all know what that is? You under 30 people who grew up with computers? Let's see. Not that many digital natives in the room? Okay, you're in the minority. That's because now half of the U.S. population is a digital native. There is using a seamless blend of communication, information, and entertainment via smartphones. So when government wants to capture the attention of young people, Newsom points out, it should be fun, it has to be social, and it has to be habitual. Arianna Huffington calls Gavin Newsom one of the most tech-savvy elected officials in the United States, and New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg writes that Newsom is helping to lead a new generation of government leaders who think like entrepreneurs and who understand that technology can transform the way citizens interact with government, just as it is transforming the way we live and work. And we are so lucky tonight to have in conversation with Gavin Newsom our own Pat Morrison. Pat, who is a great friend of the Los Angeles Public Library, is, as you know, a writer and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, where she's won numerous awards, including a share of two Pulitzers. And in addition to the Times, she's a regular commentator on NPR's Morning Edition and has published a best-selling book on the Los Angeles River. And, of course, among her other honors, Pink's Hot Dogs has named a veggie dog after Pat. So that's pretty cool. So please join me in welcoming Gavin Newsom and Pat Morrison. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. All right.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. And Louise, thank you, as always, for that, and to the library for the wonderful programs. There's Ken Brecker back there. And if they ever foreclosed on my house, Ken, you would find me living here because this is my second home. Libraries in general, and this library in particular, you know, have my heart.
Yeah.
So. Now, some of you may have seen that Norman Rockwell illustration of an earnest man standing up at a little New England town hall and saying his piece. What a passionate piece of American iconography. About 150 years ago in this very city, they used to ring a gong to assemble the citizens of Los Angeles, and they would have a show of hands to vote on issues. Of course, this is when probably more than half the population wasn't eligible to vote. But that's the way we did democracy. Yeah. Now Gavin Newsom's book says there's going to be a different way that we do democracy, and it's what you have in your pocket and your purse and at home, and in the laptop that you carry around with you, and maybe the iPad as well. So Gavin Newsom's going to lay out his premise, and then we're going to talk about some of the notions behind it, how it would change democracy, and then we'll be getting to some of your questions as well. So thank you again for being here
and
for your book.
It's an honor to be with you. I'm grateful you took the time to do this.
Not at all. It's my
pleasure.
And
I like the way you opened that up.
So did they do that in San Francisco? You sounded a gong and everybody came and voted?
you want to get into San Francisco. That's a whole nother beast. I love it. Someone once best described San Francisco as 47 square miles surrounded by reality, which is a great way to describe my hometown. So we could talk about that reality, or we could talk about this new reality that we're arguing for in Citizenville.
What I took away as I was reading your book was that how the medium could change the message. And you really believe in that because people right now feel disaffected about politics. They feel detached. We have a municipal election in Los Angeles next week where if the turnout breaks 15%, I'll lose a lot of money in bets.
You're right.
So stay home, everybody. Okay. Yeah.
And Pat, that's registered voters. You know, I opened up this book with the LA election a couple of years ago, 12%. And I was just stunned. You know, you had 6 or 7 council members, 10 big ballot initiatives, and they were significant ballot initiatives. And I remember reading the election day coverage, and I was curious what the turnout was and couldn't find it. And then I found out it was just 12%, and I couldn't believe that it wasn't a headline. And the reason it wasn't a headline, it had been a trend line for years. It wasn't that significant because the previous election, just 13% of people turned out. And so you're right. I could imagine next week, particularly with no other significant issues in front of you, that this turnout for an important race, the leader of your city for the next 4, potentially 8 years, that if it breaks 15, I'm with you. We both lose some money.
So why do you think that the technology, which in effect for some people it's a gizmo, it's a gadget, for other people it's a tool, why do you think it's going to change at all the sense of engagement? How hard is it just to walk around the corner and vote?
Well, let me back up. Let me connect some dots and then answer that question specifically. You know, I think it was Justice Brandeis who said it better than anyone else, said, in a democracy, the most important office is the office of citizen. And we've kind of forgotten that. Our individual and collective responsibilities of engaging, not just to vote. I mean, we're 138th in the world. You're hardly unique here in Los Angeles. This country is 138th in the world in voter participation. So that's been a trend line for generation now. But the whole idea of citizenship is something that has really been brought to the fore in my search as I went out and interviewed some 68 people over the last year and a half for this book and looking at the issues of technology. And I came from this frame that we use technology relatively well and effectively to get elected. You just think about the Obama campaign in 2008. 35 self-organizing communities came together, mybarackobama.com, this sort of modern email campaign. And all that engagement and all of that connectivity, two-way conversation, it seemed we were part of this movement in this campaign. And when the election was over, all those voices that were turned on and amplified were turned off. And we reverted back to form. You vote and guys like me decide. This broadcast model of governing. And it occurred to me, and David Kettle wrote about this years ago, that government really does operate like this, a vending machine. You put in your dollar, taxes, and out you get police, fire, healthcare, national defense. And if you don't like what you get, you do what many of us in this room have done with a vending machine. You shake the machine. You kick the machine. Protest. The Occupy movement on one side, perhaps the Tea Party on the other side. It's a framework of scarcity. And it's that machine thinking that so many of us have become used to. You vote, we decide. And my book, the premise of the book, and really the initiation of the idea and construct was, you know, governing is not getting elected. And this engagement shouldn't end on election day. It should just begin. And that this idea of a one-way conversation, you vote, I decide, is losing its steam and resonance in a world where the industrial age, in many ways, is running out of steam. You think about the contours, Pat, and you understand this better than anyone, in the media industry and what's happened in newspapers, and now I'm starting to understand it with publishing. What's happened in the music industry, where you're no longer buying albums, we're downloading songs. Some of you old stockbrokers in the room, you know what's happened in the financial service industry. And the contours of this change are beginning to take shape in governing institutions. And so this is a long-winded introduction to the purpose behind the book, my exploration of these principles.
And yet I can understand why you want to take advantage of the technology, but the idea of running government the way you would ask people to vote on American Idol really alarms me, the idea of an instant plebiscite. I mean, I think it's good to get the tenor of things, but once you have people running, making government decisions on a whim, rather than with some of the mechanisms that the founders put in to deliberately slow down the process, what do you see as the consequences? And tell me what you think the mechanics are of making the technology work in democracy and not in commerce.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I want the cool minds, as the founding fathers talked about, neither monarchy nor mob rule, as the founders constructed. And I certainly am not arguing for anything differently. What I'm arguing for is active citizen engagement, not the inertia that we have today. I mean, I really do feel like, and maybe you don't, but I think most folks I talk to do, that government does things to us, not necessarily with us. I do feel like this vending machine approach when I'm engaging my city council and my state government and my federal government. I don't feel particularly engaged in the sequester debate. I don't feel particularly engaged in the new language of tomorrow, of Monday on continuing resolutions, or what we argue today on culture, all this language we're all learning. I don't feel particularly activated. And so my framework is, how can you use these tools of technology to democratize voices, to connect people's voices, to begin to self-organize in communities so that there's more of a two-way conversation, not a one-way conversation, that moves past election day, and that you are certainly, you're part of the co-production and the design of your city, our state, and the nation and the world we're trying to build. I'm not arguing against this notion of that division of governance. I certainly believe that the judicial branch and executive legislature branch have consolidated a lot of power, but people haven't necessarily consolidated a lot of power. And so what I'm arguing for, again, is not citizenship as being treated as subjects, but citizenship as being treated as co-partners and co-producers.
How would that work? Let's say there's a bill before the legislature in California that you would apply the mechanics of technology to. How would that work, and how do you keep it from being that mobocracy where you see it now? People get spam emails, legislators, fax machines are overwhelmed, their offices are inundated with email. How can you sort out what's really public's wishes, and again, what's being manipulated?
Well, let's talk about manipulation. I think all of us, most of you maybe remember the Schoolhouse Rock. Remember that 3.5-minute video where we were entertained and educated, you know, how a bill becomes a law. Well, the only thing missing was the thing that is most powerful in government today, and that's the persuasion industry, lobbyists. Because that's how bills actually become law. It's opaque. It's behind closed doors. You're not actively engaged in that process at all. It's rather laughable. And if you think you are, trust me, I, with respect, done this now 17, 18 years. I'm glad you feel that way, and I'm glad you sleep well at night. You shouldn't. You know, 2/3 to 3/4 of all the bills are written by special interest groups and handed to us. And we make some adjustments through the process, but mostly these groups are making the adjustments. And we have a little hearing or two, and the loudest voices tend to be there. You're not necessarily participating in the hearings. We may have a town hall that makes you feel good that you actively participated. But then again, you have folks that are organized with the loudest voices, and you kind of cower in the back going, geez, I feel more and more disengaged. It's a wonder we're not 158th in the world in voter participation when people feel like they're not engaged. So you're seeing, to answer your question, technology being used in very transparent and open ways to engage the public specifically in amending and organizing legislative process. There's process that is engaged specifically called Project Madison. There's something called Citizen Co-Sponsor, where every amendment is exampled with your name attached to it. The amendments are being introduced on the House floor in a transparent way, and you could track that process as it relates to a bill being adopted or at least advanced. There's ways, again, that technology ultimately can open up the opportunity for all the rest of us, not just the persuasion industry and lobbyists, to begin to take back government.
You also write about how you can use technology in citizens' needs. We have now, you can text or email pictures of potholes to the city,
yeah,
and they will get filled. And you write about an experiment called Manor Labs, how people can engage technologically with the things they need in the city in real time. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, the example you use is see, click, fix, where you literally see something, you click a picture, and it gets fixed. And these are strategies we used as mayor. Look, let me step back and connect the dots and get right to that point. When I was mayor, I took solace in this notion that President Obama was committed to this idea of being the most transparent president in history. In fact, just a week ago, he said, I am the most transparent president in history, and this in defensive posture in response to the rather questionable issues related to legal precedent for drones, the ready, fire, aim policy, the lack of due process as it relates to American citizens, and the kill list with drones, and the fact that he's not been necessarily transparent on that. Not the operational side, just the legal argument. So defensively made the argument. And he did it on this basis, that the first executive order he signed as president was an open data initiative to take from the vaults of our libraries or our agencies and federal government and bring data to the fore, to the light of day, and allow third-party developers to take that data, to scrape it up and to mash it up and to make real opportunities to solve problems and to expose a government's efficiencies as well as inefficiencies. It had fits and starts. But as mayor, I was inspired by that. And I said, you know what? Why don't I just localize this idea? And I did the nation's first local version of this open data initiative. And one of the first things I did is I said to all my department heads, I'm going to ask you all to take data sets. Take this information, transit information, crime information, information about recycling centers, just all this data. It's a treasure trove of data. And just put up some data sets up there online so people can download them. In San Francisco, you may recall, Pat, you know, gay marriage I was involved in, which some asserted as controversial, but nothing I ever did was more controversial than requiring composting in San Francisco. I mean, seriously, the garbage police, cartoons, I mean, intense.
Listen, Sam Yorty won an election here in Los Angeles because he said housewives shouldn't have to sort their trash. So there's a long tradition.
I get it. Yeah, so just forewarning, any mayor wants to get into the composting business, call me. Anyway, I was very passionate about it. We have close to the highest recycling rates in the country, about 80%. That's why we did the plastic bag bans, all these things early on. And I say this only to say this. One of the first things that happened when we put our data sets up is there was an app. Just like you get your app on the iPhone or an Android, go to the app store. We decided to do an app store for government services. And when we put these data sets up, some very ingenious group of people, within hours of putting the data up, did an app called EcoFinder, where you can find the location of all your recycling centers and had instructions to make your composting much easier. Now, if I had done that as mayor, I would have had to go through a procurement process. It would have started with an RFI, an RFQ, an RFP. It would have had to go, we have gone to the lowest responsive bidder, which means we may have to rebid it. We would have had to go through that process through multiple procurement cycles as it relates to our fiscal. It would have cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, and been less efficient. It was done in hours. And it got me thinking that this is an extraordinary opportunity to amplify the ability for people to engage. What other data do we have? And we started putting all these other data sets up. And as a consequence, we have hundreds of apps now on a city app store. And other cities started doing the same, downloading for free what would have cost the taxpayers literally millions and millions of dollars. They saw you, the private sector, saw things, citizens, and formed different connections that I ever could as a mayor or government officials. And it's the old adage, it reminds me, you know, none of us is an expert in everything, but all of us is an expert in something. So how do I engage that intelligence and network that intelligence that exists inside of all of our citizens and engage in city government and begin to solve problems and design solutions that government can't?
One of the most alarming examples and obvious ones you gave, it was a chilling one, about how governments haven't converted 911 services to text only, and it has cost people's lives.
Yeah, Jennifer Kuhn, 19. You know, there was a horrible, you may recall, early 1900s, a woman.
Not early 1900s, surely.
Excuse me, 1900s and 1990s. 1900s.
The Queen Victoria
app.
Yeah,
Queen Victoria. With her cell phone, yeah, with her smartphone. But
it played God Save the Queen with
it. Tragic. She had her phone. She was captured in the back of the car. She called 911 on the phone as her captor was driving away, kidnapping her, but couldn't talk because he was right there. But she could have texted. But 911 doesn't allow you to text. For 18 years now, we've been debating this, and we still don't have the technology. And she could be alive today, and many others, if we advance the technology. And it just pointed out just one of many examples. You know, government technology is on the leading edge of 1970. We really are. And if you think I exaggerate, just consider your own LA Times. 10 so days ago, what happened? DMV dropped a $208 million contract to upgrade its license technology. In that article, you may have seen we spent about $135 million, we, all of you, me included, spent $135 million. It's not even halfway done, and we fired the contractor. What the article also said is that means we're left with what? 40-year-old technology that could collapse like that. Now, that's a scandal, but wait a second. Let me give you the real scandal of technology. In 2004, we submitted a $260 million appropriation through the courts to appropriately upgrade the record management system, the case management system for all the 58 county courts in the state of California. It was going to be done in 2008, $260 million. Well, 2008 came and went. 2010, we decided to reflect on the contract, already spent $500 million, and realized it wasn't even a quarter of the way done. And they projected that they can finish the project, $260 million, not in 2008, but for $1.9 billion, we can finish the work in 2015. There was one subcontractor that had 103 change orders on their $33 million component that's now over $103 million. Now, I bet none of you know that. But I bet every single one of you in this room, with maybe three or four exceptions, know about the scandal at the Parks Department last year. And what was that scandal? We didn't spend the money we had. It's an extraordinary thing that would resonate as a dominant and appropriate issue, scandal, but you don't know about the $371 million payroll system that we were upgrading 2 weeks ago, where we also fired the contractor there. You know, we're still building out IT systems while your nieces and nephews are building for nothing websites on the weekend for fun. And yeah, these are the things that I think we have to substantively address, and those are in the book.
No, you've got CPUs in government that are the size of Morrill Rock, right? And
yeah.
Then nowadays the rest of us can do it like this. What are the mechanisms for undoing that, for making it work more efficiently? This is where we invented this stuff, for goodness sake.
And this is, again, the purpose of this book. I mean, this is not sexy. I get that. You know, scandal, you know, all this, who's up, who's down, who's going to win the sequester by, here's a new public opinion poll. That's all wonderful and captivating. I mean, it's like watching, you know, I'm a sports fan. I like ESPN 1, 2, and 3. But, you know, we have the version of that, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, you know. And we just consume who won the news cycle, who tripped up the other party and got that crowbar and put it in the spokes of the other party and won the day. Meanwhile, you've got this iceberg underneath of government of complete inefficiency, and you're just focused on whether or not the president should have allowed his wife to open up an envelope on the Academy Awards. And so, you know, this is the part of government that's just missing. And this is what I'm ultimately trying to address. And here's why we do. Because here's the great burden. Because we led, we fell behind. Because we stopped investing in that lead. We built these big systems, these legacy systems, and we're stuck with them. And we had 5- and 10-year contracts. I open up the book in the second chapter. The introduction's about the second largest city, LA, and this 12% of people voting. The first chapter opens up with my effort to impress the president of Estonia. Now, all of you are quite familiar with Estonia, so I don't need to explain that I wasn't. But nonetheless, tried, you know, I'm some hotshot 34-year-old, whatever, mayor, you know, of San Francisco, tech-savvy guy. And here's Tomas, president of Estonia, comes in my office. He's out to visit folks in Silicon Valley and does what, you know, good presidents do, justify their trip by meeting with the local mayor so they could justify the cost to the taxpayers. So it's a perfunctory meeting. And I wanted to impress him because I was announcing a move to provide free Wi-Fi in San Francisco with the founders of Google. And so I was waxing on about how fabulous it was. And he's standing there nodding. And, you know, sure. His translator's there. He speaks perfect English, but his translator was there translating. And then I went on to say, you know what? Check this out, Mr. President. I know the Wi-Fi is impressive, but let me just tell you about this technology. We're going to actually be able to pay. Instead of putting a quarter into a parking meter, you can do it on your cell phone. And he looks at me, and he sort of holds back his translator and says, well, I've got this. And I said, I know you're impressed, Mr. President. And he says, oh, yeah, hold on. And he goes, you know, with all due respect, Mr. Mayor, all wonderful, but we've been doing all of that for a decade in Estonia. We've been paying not just parking meters, but parking tickets, property taxes with our cell phones. We've had Wi-Fi for years. Heck, I know there's controversy out here with the last Bush election around online voting, but we now are doing experiments with that. And I was just stunned and flabbergasted. Here I was trying to be impressive. And here's some guy from Estonia and telling me that he's got 200% penetration rate with cell phones. And it's because, here's the long-winded point, they leapfrogged. He didn't have all the legacy burdens that we have out here in the United States. When they came out of the Soviet Union in 1991, they didn't have all this old stuff from the 70s that we purchased and are patching together. He just jumped to the next generation. And countries around the world have done the same thing. Does it surprise you that South Korea has the fastest download speeds in the world? We're now 26. Someone said, no, we're 28th, but I'll give you the 26. We're 26 behind Romania and Latvia in download speeds. You can't make this up. And so this is a world. We're no longer in a connected world, but a hyper-connected world. And as I said, this industrial economy is increasingly showing signs of running out of gas as it relates to these industries that I speak of. We're on a collision course with the future in government. And you know that when you go to the DMV.
But let me ask you about some of the hurdles. And one of them, of course, is the how slow government has been to embrace it. The other one is how we have built in competition that's sometimes counterproductive. People come here from Europe and they find our speeds are very slow. People make money on cell phone systems in Europe. They make money on data systems. But here we have built in an almost inefficiency of competition. You take your phone to a store to get a charger, and there are 10 different kinds of chargers. How do we then, we have this paradox of citizens versus consumers, and how can government do that kind of leapfrogging without these competitive issues that seem to be so much a part of procurement, of government, and even our way of thinking about ourselves as consumers rather than as citizens?
Well, you know, I say this with respect because these are a lot of my friends run these companies, and it's probably the inartful way of phrasing it, but I do it in the book, so I'm kind of stuck with it. But we have IT cartels in here, in this state, and they've been taking advantage of all of you because they can. Scandal after scandal. Because they can. And it's lucrative. It's extraordinarily lucrative. You know, we have not one state agency that's gone to the quote-unquote cloud. I had to break all the rules and do it without any permission and just broke off with everyone else and just brought in, and we paid for it ourselves in my little department, at Lieutenant Governor's office. It's that antiquated, the mindset. It's still centralized. We're still building things. When folks don't even need to buy things, you're just renting things. It's an on-demand resource, the cloud. You're getting the best iteration, and you get it for as ever long you want. And so we've got to change the culture, not just the technology, but change the culture in terms of how we approach these things. We're living in a world, we talked in the introduction about digital natives. You know, I really did think, I have a 3.5-year-old, but I kid you not, she was about 1 year old. She couldn't walk, crawling, just learning to crawl. She certainly couldn't talk. And she found my iPhone. And she must have found it multiple times, but I hadn't paid attention. And all of a sudden, I'm watching her go in. It's just, and you've seen this with your kids and grandkids, haven't you? Just unbelievable. She's discovering things I've never seen. And I literally stopped my track, called my wife, said, she's the one.
Her first word was Google?
Yeah, no, I mean, just, I thought, honestly, I said, you know, I've been talking, Catholic, I mean, this is the one. And I was convinced. I mean, you know, look at this. Never seen anything like it. She goes to the TV. She doesn't know why it doesn't do this. Magazines. This is mesmerizing. Until about a year ago, she, you know, they start early in this pre-preschool, and I looked around, and every single one of these kids was doing the same thing. So disappointed was I. These kids are growing up digital. Their brains are wired differently than our brains. I'm a digital immigrant. I'm learning the language. But these kids, especially those 140 million or so under 30 years old, this millennial generation, the generation of choice, the net generation, these netizens. You know, it's all about customization. It's all about local, mobile, social, cloud, ubiquity access information, the ability to customize services. And yet here we are in this vending model, this machine model of governing, where it's standardized. I mean, the idea, seriously, and I say this respectfully, that we're debating as if it's the end-all debate, seniority and tenure as the dominant school reform initiative that's defined so much the culture of stress of the LA Unified School District and Eli Broad here, Michelle Rhee here, and the school, you know, CTA, is, with respect, laughable. You know, we still are sending our kids into classrooms that were designed to pull kids out of the agrarian age into the industrial age, with bells that literally were the same bells that Ben Franklin heard ringing, with rows of desks. And we put these kids, based on their date of manufacture, meaning their age, in the same group to teach single subjects, to have a teacher broadcast to them. It's a stunning thing, mass education, fast food education, in a world where everything else is being customized to you. And so this, to me, is profound. My kids, your grandkids, your kids, can't not be educated as we were. And we've got to disabuse ourselves that we can play in the margin. Because this is, the change is radical. And as I say, it's no longer a notion of hyper, or rather connected, but it's hyper-connected. And so I'd love, when we have more time, to indulge a little more deeply on my red flag concerns about the significance of what I'm arguing for.
One of my red flag concerns, when you use the word customizing, it seems to be, to me, to be antithetical to democracy. Because you talk about, you quote writers in here saying, we're moving toward a world in which the internet shows us what we want to see, but not what we need to see. Google and Yahoo don't have reporters at City Hall. They don't have them at the Commerce Department. But they cover sports. They cover Hollywood because that makes money. That's what they want to see. If you customize, how do you guarantee that you bring people into a democracy with a broad knowledge when all they may want to find out about is Michelle Obama's bangs?
Yeah. Well, it's right. You know, it's interesting. The context of that is something that maybe many of you have heard, some of you I'm convinced have not. You know, if you and I, if we together right now all went on Google, same search engine, and you on your iPhones, if some of you have some iPads, or even if you had your laptop, and we all did the exact same Google search, you know, LA Library, main library, your results on that same platform are going to be completely different than my results. So to Pat's point and concern, there's this what we call filter bubble that begins there. It's not just, you know, Pat's watching or reading Drudge and I'm reading HuffPost, or I'm, you know, watching Fox and she's watching MSNBC. Has some fun here. And we're getting a different set of facts. But we even start with that baseline information where we're being filtered. By the way, there's 57 different inputs that go into making a determination of what your search is, because those searches are now being customized. So you're right. We don't even begin with that same baseline of knowledge, which is
does
a point
that concern
of real,
you?
It absolutely concerns me. And we talk about the antidotes in there of different platforms to engage in more of the sort of, and we talk about 2,400 years ago, going back to the old forum example in Greece, where people were randomly selected as it would be a jury today and engage in a deliberative and a Socratic framework where the same set of facts, it's more like deliberative polling is today, and have a framework of real deliberative engagement that is immune from those persuasion interests that are coming in to manipulate those facts. And again, technology is working its way through this because we have the tribes of like minds that we're seeing online just as we see it offline. And now we're seeing the contours of these new sites that are beginning to bridge that gap increasingly. So I'm more optimistic about technology's ability to begin to address those concerns.
One concern that other people have, too, is privacy. And we, in a way, have flipped the European model where people trust government more with their information than with businesses. It's rather the opposite here. And there are very strict privacy protections in Europe that put them in conflict with companies, as you know, like Google. And the latest story about Google apps and the information that, in exchange for that app that you give, perhaps unwittingly, to Google, what are your privacy concerns? Because we were talking in the green room about, you know, those cards you get, those discounts at the grocery stores if you become a loyal club member. When I signed up for those, I used not my own name or address, but the names of famous murderesses and the address of LA County Jail. And so I'll check out at Pavilions and they'll say, "Thank you, Ms. Borden." Now, obviously, this isn't a credit card, but I, you know, I pay cash at the gas station. I pay cash because I would not use my credit card for or my phone for a parking meter. It's nobody's business where I'm parking for half an hour.
They do use that information.
So how do you address those privacy concerns, especially in democracy where we do have sunlight? You do have public records for voter registration, for property records, for any number of things.
Right. It's public data. It's publicly supported and sponsored. It's your right to know, presumably. A couple thoughts on this. You know, I thought long and hard about this, and I tried to be reasonably self-reflective, as much as a politician can, on my own struggles with this notion of privacy and openness, particularly as it relates to the media and the friction between elected officials and the media with the Freedom of Information Act. Because every time you want to, anytime politicians are asked to give up information, it's always a hit piece. It's just inevitable. It's a five-part series in the LA Times. It's tomorrow's hit piece. And so the default for politicians is to try to maintain as much privacy about what's going on as legally possible, just to be responsible to get it out there. The world now, and President Obama is learning this, is now framed in the context of what Stuart Brand, years and years ago, the original white hat hacker, who worked with Wozniak and Steve Jobs in the early 80s and talked about this open source movement, coined the term, the phrase, information ultimately wants to be free.
Can I stop you right there, because that was only half of his phrase, and I asked him about it last year. He said information also wants to be expensive, and that's where the paradox is.
Right, and it's no longer expensive. Knowledge is no longer expensive.
It may be expensive to get, but people don't want it to be expensive from their end.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, because I love to compare our notes and our conversations with Stuart, because we went deep into this, and I'm going to get back to that, because that's an important point.
Let's call him right now, shall we?
Let's get him on the phone. Call a friend. But back to this point of privacy. You know, in the age of WikiLeaks, what privacy truly exists in government? With the age of anonymous and these black hat hackers, the China examples we're going through, what the United States does very effectively on the flip side, not just foreign governments, it's hardly just China. The fact is that we're living in a fishbowl, in a glass neighborhood, and privacy as we've known it in the past is arguably dead. Now, with that comes this argument, and I make this in the book, that privacy and transparency must go hand in hand. And this is what's missing from your example. We don't have the transparency to know our privacy is being breached when you download an app or you use that credit card in the parking meter and know that they're sourcing that information and selling that and monetizing that information. So we have to be more transparent. It's got to be informed consent. The challenge now is, though, self-evident. Privacy is now a new currency, isn't it? You can use it. You can give it away and receive something in return. The more privacy you give up, the more customized your service becomes. And so it's a different paradigm. It's a different way of thinking. And this is the great struggle. With our kids, they've lived so many digital breadcrumbs, they don't see the world the way we do. But for a lot of us, we're struggling with this. And we may not want to give up that privacy. And so the issue of transparency becomes paramount in this framework and in this debate.
You also talk about, I can't find the chapter here, about the new virtual town hall where you have direct contact. I know, for example, that Councilman Bill Rosendahl, everybody in his district has access to his cell phone number. I mean, how does that work in terms of informing the mechanics of democracy and making legislation happen, making policy happen as well?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess my argument in this book is I don't want all of us to find new ways of petitioning government to do something. I want to find a different mechanism where we can do things together. You know, I don't want just a new fancy petition site. And President Obama, by the way, infamously did this, you may recall, right after his 2008 campaign. And rightfully, he said, look, 35,000 communities self-organizing, this is incredible. We want to keep your voices amplified after the election. And he created something called change.gov. You may recall. And on the site, it said, you know, to my fellow Americans, this historic moment during the transition. We want to hear from you about what the priorities need to be. We now have a new platform to do it at change.gov. We've got a war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan. We have global climate change. We have issues of financial crisis, war on terror. What's on your mind? Participate in this historic town hall with this new platform. And he did. And as Michelle Obama may have opened the envelope, he opened the envelope, peeled it back. And what was on America's mind? Was it the war of terror, war in Iraq? Was it the financial crisis? No. It was legalizing marijuana. The dominant, there's some voices and they're excited. Now, he made a flippant remark, you may recall, infamously sort of made a flippant remark. And no one liked that because people were serious. And what happened? You can check it right now. Go check change.gov. You'll see that immediately the site went down for reconstruction and was transitioned. So this whole idea of amplifying your voices and engaging in a two-way conversation sounds great. It's not so great. And by the way, those voices were turned off until this election. And then we were getting Michelle and Bill Clinton, my friend here. You know, we had 100 friends. I miss all those folks, right? Those 25 emails we were getting every day. How are you, Bob? Yeah, great. But to his credit, he's trying to keep it going. And he's done two things. He did the We the People petition site. But what happened there? 5,000. If you sign a petition, 5,000 of you, Jay Carney, will be forced to respond. So what happens after Newtown and the tragedy? This radical from, of all places, England, who's on CNN, Piers Morgan, upsets a lot of folks. And they say it's time to deport Pierce back to the country which forced us to bear arms in the first place to defend ourselves. And that got like 70,000 signatures immediately. And here's Jay Carney sitting at a White House press conference going, you got to be kidding. I've got to answer to deporting a talk show host. And so what was the response? The Obama administration? We'll just raise the threshold of signatures. Kind of missing the whole point.
But really, I mean, isn't that not trivializing government the way that politicians have been accused of doing
as
well?
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's trivializing. These things may be important to us. But the bottom line, if you're going to have a two-way conversation, you'd be willing to commit to it. But my long-winded point is, that's not what I'm arguing for. I'm not arguing for petition. I'm not arguing for this vending machine model where you just put more pressure on me to add something else in the machine. I'm arguing for a new division of labor. I'm not arguing against solving big problems. I'm arguing for creating a platform where we can cultivate and convene and coordinate and collaborate in a completely different way than we have in the past. I'm talking about using these tools of technology, not just to engage online, but offline, and to begin to develop strategies for real citizen engagement and community building. A real bottom-up strategy that takes the principles of those self-organizing communities in the Obama campaign, but to govern like that. If there's one thing I'm critical of the Obama administration, which I'm wildly supportive of, is they're not governing as they campaigned. And that's what's missing, and that's what I'm arguing for in citizen.
You mentioned Estonia. Is there another country that does this right that can serve as a model for the United States?
Well, you know, it's the old adage, if you don't like the way the world looks, standing up, stand on your head, and go local. You'll see remarkable things happening locally, not overseas, but all across this country. You brought up a moment ago Manor Labs and InnoBucks, this notion of civic currency. And how can you take reputation? You know, a lot of folks, these hackers, these folks that do these hackathons, that build out these apps, you know, that are engaging these things, they do it for reputation, not necessarily for money. And how do you take that civic engagement, this new civic currency, and how do you create a reputational system where you can translate that into real citizen engagement? There's a town in Texas, Manor, Texas, where they've done just that called Manor Labs, where they give out virtual dollars, InnoBucks. And the local newspaper publishes those that have the most InnoBucks because they're most engaged in the life of their community, cultivating neighborhood gardens, volunteering at the library, mentoring with kids. And businesses now are taking those virtual bucks, InnoBucks, and providing discounts at local stores for those community members that are most engaged. It's trying to find ways of, again, enlivening and exciting and engaging people, using these tools of technology and meeting people where they already are. Thus the title of my book, Citizenville, which is a riff on Farmville, Zynga's Farmville, which, if you don't know about it, you should. It's unbelievable. Mark Pincus, San Francisco guy, an old friend, met him when he told me he had 100 open jobs in the middle of the worst recession in our nation's history. San Francisco's collapsing. This guy's telling me he's got a 100 jobs he's trying to hire, can't hire enough folks. And he said, I said, what's your company, Zynga? He says, well, we do games. I said, okay. It's like Atari. What do you mean? Is this shoes again? He goes, no, this is amazing. You go on and you cultivate virtual gardens. I said, okay, great. And he says, and people pay to do it, real money. And they buy, extra farming equipment. And you can't make this stuff up. And here's this guy. And I'm thinking, is this, what am I missing? Only to find out, and you all know this, if you're 8 to 18, you're spending 53 hours a week on online entertainment media. If you're 21 years or younger, there's two studies on this, say that you've spent more time playing online games than you have in the classroom. So how can you take these ideas of where people already are? And by the way, it's not just kids. You know, the average age of a social gamer? Gender, woman, age 42. You can't make that up. You know who you are. So how do you take these opportunities and principles, and how do you educate, entertain, meet people who are? InnoBucks is one of those many examples I offer in the book.
Is in the Kiva model for charity, is there a lesson for governance? Should we go to the point where we vote to say, I want my tax money to go to an interstate highway system and not to the latest iteration of a spy plane?
Yes, it's called participatory budgeting. It's fabulous. Any of you grew up in Brazil, you've been doing it for years. Porto Alegre takes a quarter of their budget every year, and you decide where the budget goes. Sure, there are some adults in the room, the representatives of government, but you decide. The process was actually used in 2011 in New York City. They took, one of the city councilmen took $6 million. And people said, this is going to be terrible. It's going to be taken over by special interest. All the money is going to be going to their best cause. You know what? African Americans and Latinos disproportionately engaged more than ever had in this online engagement with such overwhelming success and support and very thoughtful and strategic investments that now they're talking about taking it and broadening it. True participatory budgeting. There's ways of using these platforms of engagement to do so much more than just show up at a budget hearing where 99.9%, you don't know this, trust me, 99.9% of every decision is already made. The entire debate at your city council budget is about 0.001% of the budget. $20 million on a $5 billion budget. Big deal. No wonder you feel disengaged. This is about getting in the corpus of the budgets. So these are the examples that are being used. Interesting, here's just an interesting fact. In 2010, the big World Cup Brazil, you know they love soccer, the Twitter trends, they were trending higher on the participatory budgeting in terms of tweets than even on the World Cup because of that kind of enthusiastic engagement.
I want to ask you a little bit about the lieutenant governor's job. When Jerry Brown was governor the first time, one of his lieutenant governors was a man named Mike Curb, who was a record industry executive and a Republican.
Yes.
And when Jerry was out campaigning for president, Mike Curb took it upon himself to fill some judgeships. And there was a lot of question about the authority of this. And so you had Mike Curb racing to Sacramento in a car while Jerry Brown was trying to race in a plane into California airspace where he would once again be governor.
Yes.
It's a great story of a power struggle.
I know. Now I want to engage in one.
Yeah. You and Jerry are in the same party. So where's the struggle?
He just got back at 7 o'clock tonight. I've been governor. It was a beautiful. Wasn't it a great week?
I thought
it was in California. A lot of things went really well. There was a modest little earthquake today and a car chase, but I thought it went pretty well. But he's back. No, it's funny. He hasn't taken many vacations, has he? I'll try to treat him respectfully. I do think, by the way, Lieutenant Governor should run as a ticket. I've said this. It was sort of misinterpreted when I said do away with the office. I meant do away with the way we elect the office of lieutenant governor. The best practices across the country are when lieutenant governors run as teams with the governor. And so you don't have the friction of a Mike Curb or, an angry lieutenant governor may even be the same party acting out because they feel inferior and insecure.
What sounds better to you, Governor Newsom or Senator Newsom?
Well, I like doing, it was mentioned, I've got about 1,000 employees in the state and now 17 small businesses. And I honestly don't say that to impress you, but to impress upon you my passion for small business and entrepreneurialism. And I've tried to bring that into everything in terms of my governing philosophy. I mean, frankly, it's why, when I was 36 days in as mayor of San Francisco, I really didn't want to rust out. I wanted to burn out. I made the point on the gay marriage. So what? Guys like me come and go. We are a dime a dozen. I mean, I'm the 49th lieutenant governor. And seriously, I don't think three of you can remember the last, you couldn't name five lieutenant governors. You couldn't name two lieutenant governors. You go, that's right. Gray Davis was lieutenant governor. Yeah, Gray. And then Bustamante, right. You good luck who the last one was. So you're going to forget me. You didn't even know me, perhaps in that respect. And so you're given a moment in time, and you want to, and that's sort of that's the entrepreneurial side of me. And, sometimes just holding hands, talking about the way the world is, and discussing cloture or whatever the word is not as enlivening. So I like the executive is a long-winded way of saying.
So Governor of California, good job. When you
the greatest job. Mayors are the greatest job. Proximity confirms legitimacy. There's so much more legitimacy at the local level. We tend to be local optimists, global pessimists. And so for me, the magic in this country is happening at the local level. Mayors make lousy ideologues, and ideologues make terrible mayors. If your mayor came out with a Republican plan or a Democratic plan to clean up graffiti, you'd say, what the heck is he talking about? Just clean up the graffiti, Mr. Mayor or Madam Mayor. But in the state level, we have our Democratic plan on child care and the Republican counter plan on the budget. And certainly the tribal nature of the federal government, my gosh, it's only through the lens of those tribes. And so it becomes less engaged, more diffuse. And so I like the iterative nature of local government. So I'm trying to take these principles as a governing philosophy to have feedback loops, feedback system. I want to humanize government. And I think we can do that. I want to make it as smart as Google with all that feedback constantly and never-ending improvement. This notion the Japanese taught us, kanai, constant and never-ending improvement. But we can engage with these technologies to do that. You deserve so much more than you're getting. It's not about small government. It's not about government being more efficient. It's about, it's not about e-government. It's about we government. Again, a new division of labor.
Why does California find itself, its governance, simply stuck in a kind of La Brea tar pits? Is it because of the tax code? Is it because we have such an excess of democracy? Our Constitution is second only to India's in length. We have 500 constitutional amendments. It takes virtually nothing in terms of a voter turnout to amend the Constitution, but a two-thirds vote to unamend the Constitution. Why are we so messed up?
Well, we talk about mob rule, right? We talk about the persuasion industry that's taken over direct democracy. The initiative process, certainly one of the reasons, where we lock in costs, but we lock out revenue. And then we deal with that trend line and the cost, we have the Prop 13 example, many others. But I'd argue four things. One is, yes, the parties. Think about it. The guy you now forget that was the last lieutenant governor, I didn't beat him. He beat himself. He made a terrible decision by doing the right thing and standing on principle, supporting Arnold Schwarzenegger as a Republican with a temporary tax measure. He and three other colleagues did that, Republicans. All four of them are gone. Their parties abandoned them. Now, Abel Maldonado, who was the former, there were other reasons on environment, on health care, on immigration, on marriage equality. He, I thought, was wrong, and I was proud to run and beat him. But that was not one of the reasons I wanted to beat him, because he showed courage. It's the old adage, you want to move the mouse, move the cheese. You've got to change the incentives. The incentives are stacked for bad behavior. Congress is in the teens, yet they maintained control of the House. How is that possible? So we've got to create incentives for good behavior, for working across party lines. So parties are one, and I'm a proud member of the Democratic Party, but we walk the same way. Two, we choose voters, you don't choose us. Now, we finally changed that a bit with districting and gerrymandered districts. But my gosh, is that the frame federally with the census every 10 years, and these guys are locked in, and they're all worried about being primaried by the far right. When we talk about Cruz control, Ted Cruz, that's John Cornyn, the number two Republican, is under the control of Ted Cruz, Cruz control in Texas, because this freshman, because of his allegiance to the Tea Party, Cornyn is running in 2014, is paranoid Cruz will break and endorse someone like himself. He can't move. He can't be himself. So that's two. Three, money. My gosh, money. We are all bought and paid for. It's unbelievable. It would scare the bejesus out of you. I know easy it is to buy votes and buy a goodwill. And it's not the money you receive. It's the threat of the money used against you. So you have those three things. And then you have just the inherent nature of politicians, which is self-preservation. And a lack of courage, a love of ease, as Bobby Kennedy used to say, where, you know, we don't want the arrows in our back. So we'll say all these wonderful things probably. Can you believe this, Pat? Democrats dominate every statewide office. There was not one. Well, there was one, and I'm not just patting myself, but I think this is interesting, and you may disagree with this. But can you believe none of the statewide office holders came out against the death penalty? All Democrats, all of them against it. Not one came out publicly for that death penalty initiative. Not one came out for reforming three strikes. Not one has come out for taxing and regulating marijuana, to the extent you believe that or not. I mean, that's our party. That's Democrat. There's not a love of courage in this party. And privately, we're all saying we're all for those darn things, aren't we? I mean, you know, you've been to the rallies where we're talking about, you know, race disparity as it relates to crack cocaine dispense, you know, issues of drug reform. We got to end this war on drugs. Well, let's have a conversation. You know, the issue of death penalty not being a deterrent, costing too much money, and we sell all this good stuff, and then we have a chance to stand on principle. There's no leadership. We're quarreling. We're more interested about self-preservation. And I just think that's sad. I admire the folks that burn out. I don't admire the folks that rust out. And, you know, I appreciate, you know, 75 Republicans now coming on board marriage equality. It was nice to see. But I didn't appreciate all those Democrats that were with us in 2004 were nowhere to be found because it may hurt them. In 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, as people were being discriminated against and their lives were being demeaned and their families' lives were demeaned, and we were still asking them for money and getting their votes. I just think you deserve more. You deserve leadership. And people don't have to agree with you, but they at least need to know where you stand. I think that's the final point of what's wrong with government.
Let's take some questions. I think we have microphones, and if you want to raise your hand. Before we go to our first question, where are you going to be on the 2014 ballot?
well, I hope on it for re-election. I'm trying to do my best to justify the salary you provide me in this office. I do chair the State Lands Commission. I'm on the UC Board of Regents, CSU Board of Trustees, chair the Economic Development Commission, the Ocean Protection Council, and do some other work. So, you know, it is an activity trap of sorts. I mean, you actually stay busy. I know, you know, the butt of the joke is, you know, I pick up the paper first thing in the morning, read the obituaries. Oh, Jerry's doing fine. But there's some more work that is being done, and so I have to raise the bar here.
Up here.
Hello. I'm a teacher, and I work with children that have learning disabilities. I have one, too. And I heard you say before you had dyslexia when I heard you talk in the past. And if that's true, how did you go about writing this book or even doing your job?
Sorry, I can't write. Yeah, you'll never see me read a speech. I think I've read two speeches.
Can we get the mic back so we can keep
speeches
in
my life?
Thank you.
And it's been a gift because I would be fumbling through a written speech. And so you learn to overcompensate. It's one of the great gifts of all times, dyslexia. I didn't know that because, I mean, literally I was doing speech therapy for years and years. I remember going for years after school, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You know, I was in the sheds in the back of my high school with all those special kids.
The Robins?
I didn't know it. And I didn't know I was a special kid. But it turned out to be a blessing. Once you come through the self-esteem issues, which are the most difficult parts, and your poor families. I mean, those of you family members that may suffer from learning disabilities, it breaks your heart as a mother or father. And you're watching your kids struggle just to do basic things. But the gift is the ability to overcompensate and to form different connections. and to see things differently. And, you know, I joke with people, literally my businesses, naming a business Plump Jack is not sort of a traditional way of succeeding. A terrible name. And a business where we took a lot of risks, you know. And my business is, Pat, I have a award every month. The person that screws up the most gets an $800 bonus. So it's called a failure award. If we have a brief second, I know we're running out of time. I'm sorry to go down this path. But I think all this comes from my dyslexia because I'm so good at screwing up that I thought I should, walk my talk and require it in others. But I had a guy, I have a hotel up in Tahoe in the summers. It's very hot and there's mosquitoes. It was built in 1959 for the delegates of the 60 Olympics. And it really hasn't changed. We don't have air conditioning. So an older hotel. And so that we keep the doors open in the hallways. And, we have those night clerks, those crazy people are there 11 to 5 in the morning when you sometimes, roll in at 3. You're like, who is this person that would work these hours? So we had one of these guys. And the mosquitoes were really particularly bad. And we have all these ponds outside our hotel. And the mosquitoes are there, the larvae, brewing around. And so this guy on his own one day decides, before he gets to work, to pick up some catfish. And he thinks, if I can use these catfish, I'll put them in the ponds. They'll take care of the mosquitoes. A brilliant idea. The night he did that, he goes home at 5. And I get a call, true story, from Ludo, my engineer. Been with us 15, 20 years. And Ludo goes, I've never called you before. I don't know what, he literally is talking like this. I said, Ludo, what the heck is going on? He goes, I can't explain it. It's the strangest thing. I'm going to figure it out. But I must tell you, all throughout the hotel, someone has vanished. There's fish parts everywhere. There are eyeballs. There are wings. There are tails. All of this stuff. I don't know what the heck has happened. I said, geez, would call me back. Well, this is the strangest thing. I'll find out the source. Well, turns out that the raccoons had gone into the ponds and in feeding frenzy, just complete insanity, had run down the halls of our hotel, eating and spitting out the body parts of these poor catfish, and had gone mad. And so I got the call back and we figured this out. And I thought, what a magical thing. Yeah, this guy decided not just to sit back and accept the world as it is, but to actively participate in trying to fix something. It didn't work out, but we learned a lesson. He got $800 reward.
Bingo. Next question.
Hi, I was really heartbroken when Aaron Swartz committed suicide after all of the intimidation by the prosecution, when really it seemed that his intent was to share research that actually had been funded by our tax dollars anyway and to make it open to all of us. And I wondered how you feel about that and what you see the future and what we can do to remedy that situation.
Yeah, no, it breaks your heart. And you reminded me, and that's a tragic example. In the 1980s, every single one of you are the beneficiary of this movement that I'm arguing for today. In the 1980s, we decided to take the satellites that you funded as taxpayers, which, by the way, generate a lot of information. And it all went through NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Association or agency. And we used to keep it in our vaults until, interesting, the Reagan administration decided to open up that data. Didn't give it away, just said anyone can access what we access. And when they did that, GPS, as we know it, was conceived. Your car that got you here, that GPS was because of the use of government data. All of you are wondering, is it going to get even warmer this week? And you probably went online to check out the weather. All of that comes from those satellites, the Weather Channel, AccuWeather, all of those things, government data that was mashed up. Millions of jobs and billions of dollars of revenue has been generated because of that notion, taking that government subsidized. What else exists in the vaults here at the library? What else exists at your Recreation and Parks Department that can be used accordingly to make your lives easier? This is this idea of government as a platform. Taking all the UC system, all that research, Sandia Labs, Lawrence Livermore Labs, Lawrence Berkeley Labs, NASA Ames, down there at Scripps, all these other agencies, what exists there that could be mashed up and used? And so that's, again, these are the principles of default openness, transparency, not secrecy, and not the frame that related to this tragic incident that you referred to.
Over here, question.
The question is more related to your book. I'm wondering if we do upgrade our services that we engage in the government into a digital experience, are we at risk of leaving behind the digital immigrants that are a generation ahead of yours, more like your parents' generation? That would be my concern.
Yeah. No, and I'm not arguing for replacement. I'm arguing for a hybrid, and I'm arguing to address the contours of this change and the reality that we're already in the midst of this kind of friction that exists. I'm talking about you. I mean, how many of you, I'm just curious, regardless of your time of life, how many of you have downloaded an app? It's interesting. And not all digital natives that just said that. Well, again, why? How many of you downloaded a civic app? Ah, interesting. Some of you have. I recognize a few faces. I'm not surprised. I want to see the reverse, or I want to see both. I want to see every single person take advantage of the framework of government being as efficient and effective as Steve Jobs was efficient and effective at creating this platform and beginning to design those services and streamline services, not in silos. We still operate in silos. I remember President Obama 3 years ago, great State of the Union speech. He says, every year we have a new theme. 3 years ago, it was win the future. And he says, you cannot win the future with a government of the past. I'm like, this is great. And he goes on to say, we have 15 agencies that deal with exports, 5 that deal with housing. And he said, my favorite, and it was a favorite of all of ours, he said, my favorite is salmon. When the salmon are swimming in rivers, in freshwater, the Interior Department's responsible for regulating them. But right when they go out to sea, the Commerce Agency is responsible for them. Cannot win the future with a government of the past. Sadly, there are 15 export agencies, 5 housing agencies, and Interior is still dealing in commerce. That hasn't changed. But the principle was right in this notion of being more effective. But again, it was all about silos, agencies, not interests. And we've got to focus on interests and move away from these silos that exist in government.
So here's somebody over here. All right.
Good to see you again. I met you at the World Series.
Don't rub it in, but it's been a good few years.
No. San Francisco. Being an Angel fan and...
don't bring that one up.
Seeing the Angels win in 2002, I was actually thrilled to see it.
Yeah, that's depressing.
But my question is, why does Governor Brown oppose a full medical school at UC Riverside?
Oh, well... interesting question. I think his concerns, though I haven't heard them, and I serve with them on the UC Regions, I haven't heard them expressed as with that kind of exclusion to the idea. His concern is just continuing to expand the scope of investment at a time when we have limited resources and we must batten down the hatch and get our existing house in order. That fundamentally is the concern. I don't share that concern. I'm very enthusiastic and exuberant. I don't think there's a more deserving community for that type of work that can be done. I think a lot of money is being matched up, private sector participation, as well as other agencies coming to support those efforts, and that the UC system can afford that expansion. But I don't think he's completely closed the door based on the conversations we've had.
I know this is a crowd that understands the penultimate question right here.
I have a thank you and a question. The thank you is thank you for being a leading activist in support of gay rights and marriage equality.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And the question is, how do you predict the Supreme Court rule on the Defense of Marriage Act and Proposition 8?
Well, I thought it a significant thing, as I mentioned, even Meg Whitman, remember, who campaigned vehemently against Brown and against same-sex marriage, came out and supported a brief, an amicus brief, a friend of the court's brief today, with 74 other Republicans, active and those that have retired, was a significant moment. I mean, this idea that Dick Cheney and others are making phone calls, as Cheney did, Vice President, in Maryland to support legalization of same-sex marriage is extraordinary to me. The idea that the President of the United States, who literally tried to avoid any connection to this issue and folks that were on board for years, would actually come out and be as supportive as he has been, and his Department of Justice being as aggressive on the DOMA case, and hopefully they have a few days to do a friends of brief brief on Proposition 8 is pretty incredible. I have great hope and expectation because the court, as some pundits believe, is just going to be divided to court of one, Justice Kennedy. And he infamously, in the Romer decision in Colorado, was the majority on a decision that was not completely dissimilar to Prop 8. Remember, Prop 8 took away rights that were legally already granted to people. We used a constitutional amendment, as Pat said, with just 50% plus one to take away the constitutional rights that were protecting those 18 plus thousand couples that already got married and the tens of thousands that subsequently would, those alive and to be born. If order to be consistent with that, I imagine Kennedy will be making not dissimilar arguments to the Romer decision. Mm. Final point. Some have suggested that it's not ripe, that it's too much, too soon, too fast, not just the support of same-sex marriage, but going in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, this court. But I caution you and remind you that in 1967, year of my birth, that blacks could not marry whites in 16 states in America. And until Richard Loving and Mildred Jeter had the audacity to fall in love and say, I do. Richard Loving was sentenced to 1 year in prison. They left the state of Virginia, went up to Washington D.C., got married, but they came back to Virginia.
This was a mixed-race couple, by the way.
Mixed-race couple, Mildred, African-American, Richard, Caucasian. And the law enforcement woke them up, literally broke into their home, woke them up, and arrested them. Lewd act, all that. The judge, infamously, and by the way, this is almost verbatim, the judge in the case said, God, sir, in sentencing Richard to 1 year in prison or 25 years out of the state. Interesting sentence. Said, God, sir, God put different races on different continents for a reason. God never wanted the races to mix. You're sentenced to 1 year in prison.
Or 25 years not in Virginia.
Or in Virginia. But he fought. He didn't accept the status quo. He actively participated, not as a subject, but as a citizen, and engaged the process and leaned in, didn't wait for the guy or gal on the white horse, used his moral authority, not his formal authority, and changed the course of history. And it was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court to overturn those laws in the 16 states. But here is my argument. Guess what percentage of Americans opposed interracial marriage in 67? It's a staggering number. 70% in two polls. Now, was it ripe to adjudicate interracial marriage when 70% of Americans were opposed? Contrast that to the polling today, 54% in a new poll that came out this week support marriage equality in America. Perhaps it's long overdue. So I compliment David Boies, and I compliment those that are behind this effort, and I feel very good that, as Dr. King said, that arc of history bends towards justice.
Last question.
Hi. Very honored to have a last question. My question is in regards to technology, how technology has impacted the media, and how the media impacts the political arena. And just to make analogy, when Bill Clinton had his famous gaffe, there was a speech he gave at the Democratic National Convention, and then he recovered from that. It was about one media cycle later, which in that day was about a week, and he went on to the Johnny Carson, David Letterman?
Oh, that was his really long speech. I was there.
Right.
I took a nap.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it said in conclusion, and everyone went. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
That 1988.
And so he had time to recover from that, and so there was a lot of, you know, guys back in rooms kind of putting their heads together trying to figure out what kind of spin they were going to put on, and they came up with this wonderful thing, and he, you know, he pulled it out, and obviously he is the president that we remember today.
Right.
Now, most recently, Marco Rubio had a similar
Watergate.
Sort of a gaffe, right, exactly, and went through this, but he had to respond in a much shorter time frame because of Twitter and, you know, and the new things that have happened now. So what do you think, and this is kind of a, this is an extrapolation, how soon do you think it will be because of this new technological element before a politician can run his entire campaign over the internet?
Well, I don't want to see that happen because I kind of like human beings and I like engaging folks and like seeing folks. And, you know, they said that the average phone call has dropped in terms of time more than one half. I mean, for those of you that actually still make phone calls. It's amazing. I mean, the world's changing. Our brains are being wired differently. And so your question is not, an outrageous one. And we're certainly seeing the friction, right, with the Obama administration and mainstream media right now that have criticized him, not just the golfing outing with Tiger Woods and the lack of access during that weekend, but this notion that he's not sitting down with newspapers, he's not sitting down with the media establishment in D.C. But what's lost is he's doing now more than ever reaching out to the rest of us on Google+, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Reddit, and all of these other platforms.
But that's PR. There's nobody pushing back who's expert to say, that sounds really nice, but here's the facts.
Though I'll tell you, if you heard those questions, I mean, even the questions Biden got in the last gun town hall, I put those up against any of those White House PR press conferences in terms of the White House correspondents' questions that tend to be a lot more timid. So, certainly from an investigation perspective, you and I are 100% the same page. Those one-on-one, those kind of questions, I get some of the toughest questions that, frankly, citizens don't have a problem asking, but the professionals don't want to necessarily injure their brands and are sometimes more cautious to ask. So I don't think it's an unhealthy thing. Again, I'm not arguing for the exclusion. It's a hybrid. It's doing both. Can I conclude with one final thought? I'm in politics, and I got a mic. Oh, Pat's got to go. But I really, this is important to me. You know, my father used to talk about this, and I put it in the book. You know, it said, what did King Mandela, Havel, remember Vaclav Havel, and Gandhi all have in common at the peak of their influence? Mandela, Gandhi, Havel, and King, peak of their influence, they had one thing in common, jail time. And it was a point to make this, and it's my final point because it sums up the principle of this book, that they had something else in common, moral authority, that you don't need to be someone to do something. You don't need to be an elected official to change the world. It's the whole notion of exercising your moral authority and stepping up and stepping in. That's the principle of Citizenville and citizenship. Don't wait around for the guy or gal on the white horse to come save the day. It's about active participation, standing on principle and stepping into that void. You can argue when Havel became president of Czechoslovakia and Mandela, president of South Africa, they lost a bit of their influence in those formal roles. They were degeniused in some ways. Their originality was lost in some ways. So don't let life degenius you. As Lincoln said, we're all born originals. Many of us die copies. Don't die a copy. Step in, step up the void, and to the extent you wish, please buy the book, and I will sign all of them as you wish. Thank you all very,
Gavin
very much.
Gavin Newsom, love your library. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.